All right, let's pick up where we left off in the book of Revelation. We left off in chapter 18. Now, ideally, chapters 17 and 18 almost should be read together. And the reason I say this is because both 17 and 18 deal with what is referred to in the Bible as the mother of harlots. But there's two sides to this coin. Okay, when we went through chapter 17, we dealt with the mother of harlots. In other words, where all the false religious systems originated from. Way back, when you go back to the book of Genesis, and you will read about a man named Nimrod. And he was basically a world leader at the time. And everybody at that particular time spoke the same language, lived around the same area. And in order to galvanize everyone into basically one world government, Nimrod decided that he was going to have everyone build this huge, massive tower that not into the heavens. I mean, these people weren't dumb. What they were going to do is build this huge observatory platform in order to observe the movements of the stars and the planets, in order to be able to calculate various days in the calendars and so on and so forth. But they were also going to use it to predict the future and to actually get control over people. It was the beginning of all the occultic systems that we have today. I'm up to here with people who are telling me, well, the whore of Babylon is the Catholic Church. If anybody who says that, I'm going to tell you right now, you are not only off base, but you are almost willfully ignorant, because you miss the mystery of what's involved here. Because I'm telling you, this whore, this prostitute, this harlot, you know, encompasses far more than any one particular denomination. And in the end times, when Christ takes away his church, what's going to happen is you're going to have an amalgamation of all the religions of the world. And you know what's going to be the big buzzword for that? You can see it in the conventions, the political conventions. The big buzzword is being inclusive. Everybody wants to be included, right? And so you're going to see this one world church, probably under the World Council of Churches. Okay, the World Council of Churches, something like 30 years ago, had something like 250 mainline denominational churches. Now they're up to around 300. And believe me, once the true church is taken out of the world, then you're going to have not just all the churches as far as the Catholics and the Protestants and the cults, but you're going to have everybody that's going to be included. You're going to have the spiritists, you're going to have the occultists, you're going to have the people who are into witchcraft, into white magic, into black magic, into Satanism, into everything that you can conceive of. This is what's going to be one big amalgamation as far as the religious system is concerned. And but it had its roots way back in Babylon. That's why she's referred to as the mother of harlots. When you get a system that begins to turn away from God and look to these other things, all right, these are the false religious systems. And in the tribulation period, this harlot that is the Bible refers to, it's not a literal harlot, okay? It's not a literal prostitute. You got to keep something in mind. From the scriptural point of view, God always looks at his people as being his wife. And you look at, back in the Old Testament, the Jewish people were referred to as the wife of Jehovah. In the New Testament, the church is referred to as the bride of Christ. So you see a situation where, you know, God's people, when they are led astray into either occultic practices or other forms of idolatry, they are being immoral in a spiritual sense. That's what we have to keep in mind here. Now, we went through, you know, all these different false religious systems the other night when we went through chapter 17. Now, the other side of the coin, it deals with what else originated in Babylon, and that is, quote unquote, the love of money. Okay? The Bible says very plainly in Timothy that the root of all kinds of evil is the love of money. Now, not money itself, but the love of it. And I'm going to tell you right now, people will do anything for money. There's not one sin that I can possibly conceive of. If you can think of one, I'll give you $10. That's how, you know, that men have not committed for money, either directly or indirectly. And that's not to say that every sin that men commit is for money. But you name me one thing that men or women have not done for money. Now, see, money has become the biggest idol of the entire world. This is a whore in God's mind, because men have prostituted themselves from the beginning of Babylon until this day, and you can see it. Now, there's nothing wrong with money, all right? But it is so tenacious. It has become the idol that we see all over the world. It is an idol. When we read the scriptures tonight, it'll talk about this particular whore being the same in all the earth, all the land. In other words, I don't care whether it's an American dollar, I don't care whether it's a Mexican peso, I don't care whether it's a Russian ruble or the English pound or the Japanese yen or whatever currency you can think of. You can see it all over the world that men have a lust for money. And this will turn man's attention from God and away from God. And Jesus himself said, man cannot serve God and mammon. Mammon equals wealth and money and materialism. He says you can either love one and hate the other, you're going to cleave to one and despise the other. We have been given this warning over and over and over again. So when we read this chapter 18, what's kind of significant is when we went through chapter 17, almost everything we read there was symbolism. When you read 18, almost everything that we read tonight, well, you can take literally. However, what's really interesting is that we have to couple chapter 18 with the fifth chapter of Zechariah, because in the fifth chapter of Zechariah, that's what gives us the symbolism that Revelation doesn't. Okay, so let's just quickly read this, and then we'll break it down. And it says here in this verse 1 in chapter 18, it says, after these things I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory, and he cried out with a mighty voice, saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the great, and she has become the dwelling place of demons, and a prison of every unclean spirit, and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of her passions of her immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that you may not participate in her sins, that you may not receive her plagues. For her sins have piled up as high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Pay her back even as she has paid, and give back to her double according to her deeds in a cup which he has mixed twice as much for her. To the degree that she glorified herself and lived sensuously, the same degree to give her torment and mourning. For she says in her heart, I sit as a queen and I am not a widow and I will never see mourning. For this reason, in one day her plagues will come. Pestilence and mourning and famine, she will be burned up with fire, for the Lord God who judges her is strong. And the kings of the earth who committed acts of immorality and lived sensuously with her will weep and will lament over her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance because of fear of her torment and saying, woe, woe, the great city Babylon, the strong city, for in 1 hour. Now look at how many times it says 1 hour as we read this. For in 1 hour your judgment has come, and the merchants of the earth weep and mourn over her, because no one buys her cargoes anymore. Cargoes of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet and every kind of citron wood and every article of ivory and every article made from every very costly wood and bronze and iron and marble and cinnamon and spice and incense and perfume and frankincense and wine and olive oil and fine flour and wheat and cattle and sheep and cargoes of horses and chariots and slaves and human lives, and the fruit you long for has gone from you, and all the things which that were luxurious and splendid have passed away from you, and men will no longer find them, and the merchants of these things who became rich from her will stand at a distance because of the fear of her torment, weeping and mourning, saying, woe, woe, the great city, she who has clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, for in 1 hour such great wealth has been laid waste, for and every shipmaster and every passenger and sailor and many of and as many as make their living by the sea stood at a distance, and they were crying out as they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, what city is like the great city? And they threw dust on their heads and were crying out, weeping and mourning, saying, woe, woe, the great city in which all who had ships at sea became rich by her wealth, for in 1 hour, again, 1 hour, she has been laid waste. Rejoice over her, O heavens, and you saints and apostles and prophets, because God has pronounced judgment for you against her. And a strong angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, thus will Babylon the great city be thrown down with violence and will not be found any longer, and the sound of harpists and musicians and flute players and trumpeters will not be heard in you any longer, no craftsman of any craft will be found in you any longer, the sound of a mill will not be heard in you any longer, and the light of a lamp will not shine in you any longer, and the voice of the bridegroom and a bride will not be heard in you any longer, for your merchants were great men of the earth because of all the nations that were deceived by your sorceries, and in her was found the blood of the prophets and the saints and all who have been slain on the earth. Okay, now listen, this almost reads like a legal document. What I mean is, what you find here is like four sets of different seven things. Okay, it talks about, you know, in this particular city you find gold and silver and precious stones and fine linen and so on and so forth. It breaks it down. In other words, it's almost as though God wants to make abundantly clear there's not going to be any loopholes here. I don't know if everybody remember when we went through the book of Daniel, we read about the night when Babylon under Belshazzar was overrun by the Medes and the Persians. Well, they were having this big glorious party and everybody's getting drunk and they were using all the utensils that were from the temple in Jerusalem. And they were worshiping what? Anybody remembers? It says they were worshiping the gods of gold and silver and stone and ivory and precious wood. They were worshiping all these things. They were worshiping this whore. Okay? This is the thing that has turned men's hearts and minds from God like no other thing that you can imagine, is the love of money. Now, I want to say something again. There's nothing wrong with money. Money can be a very good servant, all right? But it can be a very tyrannical master, and people don't see it. There's a lot of people in churches today who wouldn't think of joining themselves to this particular whore as far as a religious whore. They wouldn't think of getting into a false religious system, or, you know, or getting into a cult, or getting into anything that, that deals with witchcraft or sorcery or anything like this. But they have no discernment when it comes to the love of money. People do not see what's involved with this particular harlot, do they? When it comes to the love of money, they think, well, gee, you know, I don't love money because I'm so generous. Are you generous? Hey, here he comes. You know?
Hi.
Hey, Bill.
Welcome.
Go ahead. We left your seat over there.
Right here.
Go ahead.
Hey,
don't let this guy trip and stumble because he'll just...
What'd you do? Bribe these people? Get them here?
I told him
you were coming, Bill.
Yeah.
Johnny's very glad to see you. He's taking the cool chair and giving you the one he kept warm for you.
Oh, that's what it is, a hot chair.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I told everybody you were coming, Phil. All right. Listen, okay, like I said, I didn't want to get off on here, but what I'm saying is we don't see it, okay? It's very easy for us to be lustful, to be coveted when it comes to money. All the different surveys and polls that they take, they say that people constantly think more of money than virtually anything else. I don't care whether it be sex or entertainment or relationships. Money is always on people's mind. I'm no different from anybody else. I'm always struggling there. Boy, wouldn't it be nice to win the lotto or something to get to a point where you could just, you know, get off this darn treadmill, you know what I'm saying? And it's kind of like the proverbial carrot that's always dangling before our nose. But Jesus talked about, hey, the deceitfulness of riches. We've got to be very careful of that because we may think to ourselves, well, if I could just win the lotto, if I could just get a lot of money, then I would be content, and then you know, I could pay all my bills, and I could be happy and so on. But it's a deceit. People are deceived by that. If you're not content with what God has given you, believe me, you're not going to be content if you get a lot more. We have to learn the secret of being content. If we can learn the secret of being content, then money can be a very, very powerful servant. Now, what I want everybody to do, okay, if you can't find it, don't worry about it, but I want you to turn back to the book of Zechariah, okay? Now, it's towards the end of the Old Testament. The last book of the Bible is Malachi, and Zechariah is right before Malachi. I want you to turn to the fifth chapter, and if you can't find it, don't fumble around for the next few minutes. Just listen, okay? Because this Zechariah 5 goes right along with Revelation chapter 18, okay? Because it deals with the love of money and the consequences of this. Now, this is the symbolism that goes with chapter 18 in Revelation, because it says here, now Zechariah, I don't have time to give a lot of background on it, but Zechariah was actually born in Babylon as an exile. And he came, you know, back to Jerusalem when they were allowed to go back. And that, you know, he was a prophet of God that prophesied in Jerusalem, but he was actually born in Babylon. So Babylon was on its way of decline when Zechariah prophesied this. He made this prophecy around, I think, 520 B.C., and he says here in that verse 1, he says, "And then I lifted up my eyes and again looked, and behold, there was a flying scroll, and he said to me," this is an angel, "and he said to me, Zechariah, what do you see? And I answered, I see a flying scroll, and its length is 20 cubits, and its width is 10 cubits. And he said to me, this is the curse that is going forth over the face of the whole land. Surely everyone who steals will be purged away according to the writing on one side, and everyone who swears will be purged away according to the writing on the other side. And I will make it go forth, declares the Lord of hosts, and it will enter the house of the thief and the house of the one who swears falsely by my name, and it will spend the night within that house and consume it with its timbers and stones. Then the angel who was speaking with me went out and said to me, lift up now your eyes and see this going forth. And I said, what is it? And he said to me, this is the Ephah or the Ephah. I'm not sure how you pronounce that. Going forth, he said, this is their appearance in all the land. And behold, a lead cover was lifted up, and this is there was a woman sitting inside the Ephah. And he said, this is wickedness. And he threw her down in the middle of the Ephah and cast a lead weight on its opening. Then I lifted my eyes and looked, and there two women were coming out from the wind in with the wind in their wings, and they had the wings like the wings of a stork, and it lifted up the FF between earth and heaven. And I said to the angel who was speaking with me, where are they taking the FF? And he said to me, to build a temple for her in the land of Shinar, where it is prepared. And she will be set there on her own pedestal. Anybody remember what the land of Shinar is?
It's Babylon.
It is the ancient name for Babylon. It is in Iraq, because Babylon is in Iraq. Let me read that last verse again. Okay. Then he said to me, the angel, to build a temple for her in the land of Shinar, where it is, and when it is prepared, she will be set there on her own pedestal. Now, let's just back up. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this symbolism, but it's important that we tie this in with chapter 18 of Revelation. Because here, Zechariah is giving two visions, and the visions go hand in hand because they deal with the love of money. It deals with people who steal. I mean, this is becoming proverbial today. People who lie and cheat and steal. Look what people will do. It's just a gall. You can see this angel throws this woman down. Why is she predicted as portrayed as a woman? Again, why? Because remember, okay, God, there's a mystery here. God's people are portrayed as the wife of Jehovah. Okay, it's like the husband and wife relationship. There's a mystery there that reflects the relationship between God and his people. And when God's people go astray because they lust after money and they forget about God, you get a situation here where, as far as God is concerned, they're an adulteress. Isn't that what we're told in James? That when we love the world, we become an adulteress. Okay, what he says here in that verse, and this is chapter 5, beginning with the first part, he says, he lifts up his eyes and he sees this flying scroll. This flying scroll, look at the dimensions he sees here. He says, it's a scroll, and its length is 20 cubits, and its width is 10 cubits. Anybody remember any portion of the Old Testament that was 20 cubits by 10 cubits?
Noah's Ark?
No.
Wasn't it the temple?
Good. What part of the temple?
The curtain or
the Holy of Holies. Yeah. The Holy of Holies. It was the very Ark of the Covenant was set. It was the very Holy of Holies. That's why I think this flying scroll is very significant, even in its dimensions, because it points to the very holiness of God. You know, and how our relationship with Him is tied in with our honesty, with our integrity. And our relationship with Him is so important. And this, so the dimensions here show that, hey, God hasn't changed in terms of what His demands are upon us as far as our holiness is concerned. And when it comes to money, it's so easy to rationalize. It's so easy to justify, isn't it? I mean, I don't want to use myself as an example, but I'll use this as an example anyway, just to tell you where I'm coming from. I remember one time I was going back in the break room and I was... they had a coffee machine there, and I put in 35 cents, and it was only 30 cents for a cup of coffee, but I was also buying some other people some coffee. Well, I get my cup of coffee, but then I get 30 cents change. I said, well, this is weird. So I buy another cup of coffee, and I get a cup of coffee, and I get 30 cents change. I buy a third cup of coffee, you know, and I got 30 cents change plus a cup of coffee. And a guy came in the break room and said, hey, this thing's kind of weird. It's giving me change back, you know, when I'm getting my money. He says, oh, I'll show you a trick here. He kind of opens the door and pushes the button. He says, hey, I'll give you a free cup of coffee. Give me a free cup of coffee. And I'm thinking, well, obviously, I can't take this. I mean, it's a small thing, isn't it? It's a minor thing. It wasn't something I intended, but I'm getting this extra money. And somebody's out money who's trying to make money off this machine. So, you know, I just said, well, you know, the Lord convict me. I got to do something about this. So I just figured out what I owed, and I went up to the office and said, hey, that machine back there is busted, but here's the money for the coffee. Okay, now I don't say that to try to make myself look good. I say that because, hey, what does Jesus say, right? He said, if you are faithful in little things, you'll be faithful in big things. In other words, if you take a cube of butter without paying for it in a cafeteria, I guarantee you, you'll take $100 if the right time is right. Right, see what I'm saying? We have got to make an effort to really show as much honesty and as integrity as possible when dealing with money. But look at what we're dealing with today. There are all kinds of liars and cheaters and swindlers that are all over there. They're coming out of the woodwork. They're calling on the phone all night long and these solicitations and everything like that. Look at some of the most obnoxious forms of the love of money. You know where you see it at? The court systems. Look at these lawyers, what they will do for money. They will take the truth and they will twist it and they will distort it and they will pervert it and they will deny it and they will run it into the ground because of the love of money. Won't they? They have no desire to see what? the truth and righteousness went out, hey, it's all money. And I'm talking especially these trial lawyers and these personal injury lawyers. You know, these lawsuits are going all over the country today, and most of them are bogus. They're just out for gouge people and for money and stuff like that. Hey, this is why this angel throws this woman down with contempt. You know, it says this is wickedness, because how many people have their hearts been turning for God because of the love of money or mammon or material things? This is why this is so important. When he sees this scroll, hey, God doesn't change. He's going to demand integrity and righteousness. This is the size of the scroll. But look at what he says as far as what's on the scroll in verse 3. I'm still using Zechariah chapter 5, you know, to complement Revelation chapter 18. It says in verse 3, and then he said to me, this is the curse that is going forth over the face of the whole land, the whole earth, is what it really literally means. Surely, everyone who steals will be purged away according to the writing on one side. Now, this is a scroll. Now, let's read it again. Everyone who steals. Now, see, people can justify everything and anything when it comes to stealing. I don't know how many guys that even in this room who once were in construction who would be so frustrated because they do a job for somebody and then they wouldn't get paid on time or they wouldn't get paid what they're supposed to get paid. Well, that's stealing. If you owe somebody money, you pay them up, because if you don't, that's stealing. He says here, everyone who steals will be purged away according to the writing on one side, and everyone who swears will be judged away according to the writing on the other side. What this has to deal with is, first of all, our relationship with men, and then it says whoever swears will be, you know, the other side of the coin is our relationship with God. The two go hand in hand. Isn't that what the Bible says? It says, how can we say we love God who we don't see and then hate our fellow man who we do see? So, in other words, as far as God is concerned, there's two sides to the same coin. One is our relationship with God, one of them is our relationship with our fellow man. And isn't this what Jesus said when he says, what are the two greatest commandments? Love God with your whole heart, mind, soul, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. And you wouldn't want anybody stealing or swindling and conning you out of your money, but people don't think twice when it comes to the other people's money. You see what I'm saying? This is why God looks at this as being such wickedness. Because men are so saturated with this love that they don't even see half the time how it offends God. They can somehow rationalize, justify, excuse it. So that's what he's saying here, that you know, that this basically sums up all the commandments, because it has to deal with our relationship with our Creator and our relationship with our fellow man. And it says here that what happens is a curse goes forth. This is verse 4. It says, I will make it go forth, declares the Lord of hosts, and then it will enter the house of the thief and the house of the one who swears falsely by my name, and it will spend the night within that house and consume it with its timbers and stones. What he's saying here is that, hey, your household is under a curse. Isn't this what God said, you know, and through Moses, that he is a jealous God, and he's going to visit the iniquities of the fathers upon their children and their children's children to the second and third generation? Okay? So if you've got in your household, the head of the household, the man, you know, who is a swindler, who is a con man, who is a liar, who is a thief, well, the curse goes on his whole household. And that can be carried on from generation to generation. You see what I'm saying? This is why it's so serious and so important that mother and father really set the example. You can't tell your kid, hey, don't steal nothing, and then go in and, you know, do a 5-finger discount down at a drugstore. And if your kid sees you, I can guarantee you he's going to pick that up in an instant, and he's going to, you know, be doing the same thing. You see how that curse can follow you right along? But if the parent makes every effort to show that they are people of integrity, that they are people who are honest, they are people who are trustworthy and dependable and responsible, this is going to be carried on as well. So you see what I'm talking about? This curse that's going to spend the night. In other words, it's going to begin to consume your whole household, this curse. All right? Now, I didn't want to spend a lot of time on that. What I wanted to do was this other symbolism, because it really goes hand in hand, again, with what we're speaking about in Revelation chapter 18. When we read in Zechariah 5 here, it says in verse 5, then the angel who was speaking to me went out and said to me, lift up now your eyes and see what is going forth. He goes outside and he says, now what's going forth? Now what he says here is, and I said, what is it? And he said, this is the FF going forth. Now FF or the EFF, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, but it is a dry measure that was used in the Hebrew form of trade. It's nothing more than a bushel. I think it holds something like 22 liters or something like that. It's nothing more than a bushel, okay, that they use for commerce. And in this bushel, they would put wheat, or they would put barley, or they would put grain, whatever it is that they were selling on the marketplace. It stood for commerce. All right? Interesting thing, when Jesus came along, he said, hey, nobody takes a lighted lamp and puts it under a bed, or nobody takes a lighted lamp and puts it under a peck measure or an FF. He says, what you do is you put the light up so that everybody can see by the light. All right? Jesus referred to us as the light of the world. But you know what? Our light as Christians can be extinguished or can be greatly diminished. How? Through the love of money. It can be greatly distinguished. He also said if you put it under a bed can represent luxury or ease or slothfulness or sensuality. Our light can be diminished or put out as Christians by that. This was the same thing when Jesus talked about the parable of the sower and the seed, when he said that some seeds fell among thistles and thorns, representing what?
Cares of the world.
Cares of the world and what? And the deceitfulness of riches. If your commitment, your testimony to Jesus Christ can be choked out by the love of money and the deceitfulness of riches. People say, well, you know, I don't know how many times I've told people, did you go to church today? I say, well, no, because I got to work. I don't buy it. You know, and I don't mean to be harsh here, but I work every single Sunday and I have for over 3 decades. And I'm going to tell you right now, I go to church every Sunday, and I don't say that to boast or pat myself on the back. I say that because, hey, if I can't get to church because of work, then I don't work. It's a matter of priorities. Because I could guarantee you, the same people who say to me, well, you know, I have to work so I can't get to church, I would say this. I'm willing to bet that you could go to church if the preacher said, hey, there's a $1,000 bill waiting for you here when you get here. Why? Because of the love of money. You see how God can be obscured or our priorities can be, you know, flip-flop, but we don't see it. We say, well, I got a good excuse. Baloney. That's no excuse. You'll go to church if there's a $1,000 bill waiting for you. I don't care if you have to crawl and get there. I know you will, because I would. Right? Hey, that's what I'm saying. He says here, in verse 6, he says, and I said, what is it? And he said, this is the FF going forth. He said, this is their appearance in all the land, all the earth. Like I said, it don't matter. American dollar, Mexican peso, Russian ruble, you know, Japanese yen. It don't matter. It's the same all over the world. You know, I'm not a world traveler, but I went to Vietnam. And I'll tell you right now, I'm not even in that rat hole. People were selling themselves left and right for money. You know, it's the same all over the world. He says in verse 7, and behold, a lead cover was lifted up. And this is a woman sitting inside the FF. A lead cover. And I think that's kind of significant. Because I think it was in Ezekiel where God referred to his people as all becoming dross, like the dross of base metals like iron and tin and lead. It was just the scum or the dross. Okay? They were worthless. But lead, you know, we all heard of lead poisoning. And we all know how heavy lead is. Well, this is a lead cover that the angel slams this woman down into, and he throws this lead cover over her. Now, this is very, very rich in symbolism here. Because look what else it says about the woman. In verse 8, he says, and then he said, this is wickedness. And he threw her down in the middle of the FF, and cast the lead weight on its opening. And then I lifted my eyes and looked, and there were two women coming out with the wind in their wings, and they had the wings like the wings of a stork, and they lifted up the FF between earth and heaven. Very significant in the symbolism here. Okay, he throws this woman down, but she's in the middle of the FF, kind of showing that when it comes to money, it's almost impossible to rise up spiritually. Isn't that what Jesus said? He says, hey, it is easier for a camel to go through an eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Okay, and we understand from history that the eye of the needle wasn't necessarily a threading needle, because if it was, then it really is, it could be applied there. But I think what it referred to is the huge gate to the city, which they'd close at night, but they also had a little door in the big gate that they would open up and allow travelers to come in who were straggling behind. And sometimes if they had camels with them, they had to get the camel down on all fours, and they had to push and pull and push and kick. And, you know, the hardest thing was getting that camel in his humps, pushing that hump down. That hump represented money. It's tough to get a rich person to heaven. That's what Jesus is saying here. Well, what happens? This woman becomes confined in that. I'm telling you, riches can be confining. They can be imprisoning. We can all think to ourselves, oh, gee, man, you know, it would be so great to win the lotto, man. It would be so great to be rich, right? Wouldn't it? But I'm going to tell you something. There's not too many people that can handle prosperity. There really isn't. There's a lot more people that can handle poverty or, you know, adversity than they can handle prosperity. Because what does prosperity do to us? So often, it becomes confining to the point where we don't see our need. We say, hey, we're rich. Who needs God? Right? hey, I got money. I could pay for this. I don't need to pray about it. You know, I could just pay for this, pay for this. You see what I'm saying? You become, you get this false sense of security. That's why this woman is referred to as wickedness, because it is an idol that has turned men from God in the spiritual sense. They commit adultery with this woman. They are unfaithful to God because this has become their God. It's become their goddess. See what I'm saying? This is what money can do to us. That's why we need to pray about it all the time. Money can be a good servant, and there's nothing wrong with money in and of itself. The problem is that we, by our fallen nature, are covetous, and we're greedy, and we're selfish, and we're self-centered, and we're egotistical, and we're proud, and we want this because, you know, it's going to make us, you know, shine, and it's going to make our life easier, whatever else the situation is. But the problem is, it's going to make us forget God. You know, there's not too many people in Scripture you can find that can handle money. Job was one of them. And God knew, because Job was a very rich man, God knew, hey, this man is loyal to me with all of his riches. He'll be loyal to me regardless of what happens. Because the devil didn't know it, but God knew it. Job passed the hardest test. He was a man of integrity with all of his money. And he says here in verse 9, he says, "And I lifted up my eyes and looked. There are two women." Now, here he says, he lifted up his eyes. He says this FF is going forth over all the earth. Two things this thing is doing. What's it doing? It's obscuring our vision of what?
God.
Right? It's like, we're looking up. Do we see God? No, we see money. Right? But not only that, who's looking down on it?
God.
God and heaven. This is something men look up to. This is what God looks down to. Okay, and I think Jesus said something to the effect of that in the Gospels, as far as what men place a high esteem on, God looks down on contempt. All right? So what happens here is that men, instead of seeing God, they're looking up to money. It's obscuring their vision. See what I'm saying? God's looking down on it. Right? So he also said that what happens here is that in verse 9, "I lifted up my eyes and looked, and there were two women coming out with the wind in their wings." Now, this is very important. There are two women. They're symbolized by women, because what it's showing here is, you know, the spiritual adultery or harlotry that's involved here. And it says they had the wind to their wings, suggesting what? What does this wind symbolize?
Satan's dominion.
Good.
The air.
Good, because he is referred to in Scripture as the prince of power and air. And also when we read in Daniel, it talks about the four winds of heaven stirring up all the seas. In other words, we are living in the midst of a spiritual warfare where these demonic beings, you can't see them, but they are giving such velocity to idolatry. Well, this is what they do when it comes to money, is that there's demonic forces that are at work to get men to be so involved with money and the lust of money and the pursuit of money that they don't have time for God. So it says here that there are two women, and they were coming out with the wind in their wings. In other words, there's demonic forces behind them. It says they had wings like the wings of a stork. Wings like the wings of a stork. Where in the Bible are storks mentioned?
Unclean food.
Good. In the book of Leviticus, you will find enlisted under all the unclean animals that people were forbidden to eat, storks were among the unclean birds. They could not eat. Storks, traditionally, they live in kind of marsh, swampy areas, plain areas, and they feed upon insects and rodents and filth and this type of thing. Okay, they were unclean birds. So this is not a divine mission. This is a demonic mission. All right? And not only that, it's kind of interesting. Where do we get this fable, or this cockamamie notion, this legend about the stork with the bringing the baby? What's the significance of that? Why a stork?
Big beak.
Well, actually, the storks are notorious for their protectiveness of their young and their caring for their young. They, more than almost any other bird, will care for their young and protect their young with tremendous diligence. And it almost shows what people will do for their money, right? I mean, when we start reading, we read in chapter 18, but, you know, when this whole city goes up in smoke, all the merchants are sitting there crying and whining. Are they crying for the lost people, the lost souls, the dead people? Yeah. No, it's their money. Portfolio stocks, the stocks, the bonds, this is their baby. See what I mean? This is why it's portrayed kind of as a stork, I think. All right? They had the wings like the wings of a stork, and they lifted up the FF in between earth and heaven. And I said to the angel who was speaking with me, where are they taking the FF? And he said to me, to build the temple for her in the land of Shinar, which is Babylon. And when it is prepared, she will be set there in her own pedestal. Now he says, when it's prepared, this temple. Now, what's significant now is, you know, I've wondered time and time again, is this going to be literally, you know, the same Babylon that we read about as far as Nebuchadnezzar and as far as the Old Testament is concerned? And I've come to the conclusion, yes, it is. And I always want to share a couple of things with you as far as Babylon is concerned, all right? Because we've got to get this in its proper context. I don't know if people have ever read this book. This is called The Rise of Babylon, all right? And people don't realize it, but you know, Babylon, the city of Babylon, has not only been unearthed by archaeologists, but it has been being rebuilt by Saddam Hussein, and it has been in the process of construction for the past 30 years. Did you know that? Most people don't know that. You know, there's an article here. Let me just read this one important article. This is out of the New York Times. It says, under President Saddam Hussein, one of the ancient world's most legendary cities has begun to rise again. More than an archaeological venture, the new Babylon is self-consciously dedicated to the idea that Nebuchadnezzar had a successor in Mr. Hussein, whose military powers and vision will restore Iraqis to the glory of their ancestors. The glories that their ancestors knew when all that is now Iraq was under Babylonian control as far as all these other countries. Now that was out of the New York Times International. That was October 11th, 1990. But some of these articles go way back. I have an article that I cut out of the paper. There was one in the Sacramento Bee back in 1989. It says, talk about a blast from the past. Songs written 6,000 years ago will be performed in the fabled city of Babylon as it relives the ancient days when it was the center of civilization. Tens of thousands of people are expected at the huge cultural extravaganza starting Friday in Babylon. The city was rebuilt by President Saddam Hussein of Iraq in a program to revive the splendors of the past and to build the tourist industry following the 8-year Persian Gulf War. Mm-hmm. Now, there was another article written way back in 1971, okay, saying that in the Los Angeles Times, an article printed out that the Tower of Babel, a biblical source of the world's languages, soon may rise again over the dusty plains once known as Mesopotamia. The Iraqi government is considering a plan to reconstruct part of the ruins of Babylon. And then it goes on and on, just simply saying, I'm saying this, people don't realize it, but Babylon has been under construction for over 30 years. And there's various pictures in this book in regards to what's taking place there. Okay, so I used to think to myself, I don't know how it could be Babylon. I just don't know how it could be the literal Babylon. I believe it by my faith, but you look and you wonder, how could it be Babylon? Because the place is so unstable. Okay, it's right over there in the Middle East where you've got this nincompoop, this butcher of Baghdad over there, okay, who I can't see this happening other than my eyes of faith. Now, this is my contention. It's my scenario or my belief of what's going to happen. If you remember, when we went through the first part of the book of Revelation, it talked about how there was four horsemen of the apocalypse that came forth, and one of them was a red horse. And under this red horse, the rider of the red horse had a huge sword, and he was given power to take a quarter of mankind's life, or the life of a quarter of mankind. I believe this is what's going to happen in the very beginning of the tribulation period. I believe that this is going to be the fulfillment of Ezekiel chapter 37, 38, and 39, where Russia, Iraq, all the Arab countries, and all these different satellite nations are going to go up against Israel. And there, 5/6 of the Russian army is going to be destroyed, along with all the Arab nations as far as their armies are concerned. It's going to be devastating. Well, I believe the Antichrist, after this crisis happens, and after a quarter of mankind is wiped out through a limited nuclear exchange, and I do believe the United States and Russia are going to go at it, okay, in this exchange. Well, what's going to happen? There's a good chance that Wall Street's going to go up in smoke. And you know what else is going to go up in smoke, I believe? Is Baghdad. And so you're going to have a whole world clamoring for peace, and they're going to clamor for one world government, and you're going to, everybody's going to be clamoring for something to be done. The Antichrist is going to come in and says, okay, man, I'm taking over. I'm taking charge before we all kill ourselves. This is what's going to happen. From now, and I believe this, in Jerusalem, they got the Mosque of Omar, or the Dome of the Rock, which is Muslim. I believe that's going to be bombed during this war, and it's going to be reduced to rubble. So the Antichrist is going to say this, okay, here's what we're going to do. We are going to allow the Jews to rebuild their temple right on the spot. And for you Arabs, what we're going to do for you is we're going to make Babylon the economic metropolis of the world. It's going to become the new Wall Street. And this is what Babylon is going to symbolize. You know, you go down Wall Street, you think, well, I've been down Wall Street, okay? You go down Wall Street, you don't think of Wall Street, do you? I think of the stocks and the stock market and the money, right? You go down Madison Avenue, I don't think of the street, I think of all the advertising, everything goes on in advertising. You think of Hollywood, you don't think of a city or a street, do you? What do you think of the movie entertainment tech capital of the world, right? Well, when you think of Babylon now, think of the economic metropolis of the world that's going to rise there. Now, the city's been rebuilt. People don't even realize it. But it says here what's going to happen is that when the time is right, the temple's already built. But what's going to happen is that they got these two wings, demonic beings with wings of stork that had the wind to their back. And at the right time, tremendous velocity is going to take place where this is going to virtually overnight become the economic center of the world. It's going to become this metropolis that's going to epitomize Wall Street or London or Tokyo when it comes to the money exchanges. And it's going to be what's going to be centered there is all the money barons, okay, all the bankers, all the big finances, all the big corporations. And you know what? It doesn't take that long. It always amazes me. Sometimes I'll drive down a road and there'll be nothing there. And I'll drive by 6 months later and look, where did that building come from? Where did this come from? You ever do that?
Yeah.
It's amazing, isn't it? You think, well, geez, how could he do this in such a short period of time? But I'm telling you, the city's already built. But what's going to happen? We get all the money barons of the world and all the resources, and they say, let's just put it all here. That's where it's going to go, and it's going to come up. Like I said, the wind is going to be behind their wings. It's going to give them tremendous velocity, and it's going to come up overnight. Because it's already there. The temple's built. So with that in mind, go back to chapter 18. We had to put them two together. Chapter 18 is virtually all... You could take all literal, but the symbolism was all in Zechariah chapter 5. So we'll go back to verse 1 in chapter 18 of Revelation. It says this, after these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven having a great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried out with a mighty voice, saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, and she has become a dwelling place of demons and a prison of every unclean spirit and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of her passion of her immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality. Okay, now look what happens. It's this angelic being. He's such a glorious being. He comes down, he illuminates the entire world with his presence. That says a couple things to me. First of all, you know, the earth is in such spiritual darkness, especially at this particular time, that he illuminates it like the sun, because it is such a contrast between heaven and earth, and this angel coming down. But it's a mighty angel with a very specific mission, but it also says he has coming down with great authority. And all the time you read in the Bible, you read about these angels that come down, and they speak with tremendous volume in their voices. I think it's very significant, because this angel's coming down, and he's got to have a lot of authority. Why? Because he's dealing with this economic whore. And when I talk about economic whore, think for a minute. Think of we've all seen pictures of Wall Street, right? The New York Stock Exchange, or London Stock Exchange, or Tokyo Stock Exchange, where everybody's screaming and yelling. You ever see that? Everybody's screaming and yelling to buy stocks, sell stocks, buy. Everybody's screaming. And I'm thinking, how could anybody hear anything in that madness? You know, or even go to Tahoe and Reno and you hear all the bells and the whistles and the sirens going off. Hey, money, 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 money. What? You almost need an angel with a loud voice to say, shut up. Because he's going to get everybody's attention. Because this thing's going up in smoke. You see why God is sending such a tremendous angel with tremendous authority? Because he's dealing with you know, something that men are so preoccupied with, you can't just say, excuse me, you know, right? Right? Okay, look at that verse 1 again. And after these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority. The earth was illuminated with his glory, and he cried out with a mighty voice. He didn't say, excuse me, you know. He said, fallen is Babylon the Great. In other words, it's a done deal. You fall off the Empire State Building, even though you haven't splattered on a concrete yet, you're as good as dead. Okay? Fallen. He's saying it twice. Even though she hasn't yet been judged, he's coming down and says, it's closing time. It's over. It's done. It's finished. It's through. This is over. This whole economic system is going to go up in smoke. And you know what? I don't want to get off on a tangent here, but I've often thought to myself, you know, what is it going to be like during the millennial period? I don't think, I could be wrong, but I don't think there's going to be monetary exchange of money. I don't think there will be. I think that people are going to go back to the land, and they're going to start farming their own land, and they're going to start making their own living, basically, you know, meeting their own needs. And when Christ is ruling, I don't think there's going to be money. There's not going to be that monetary exchange of currency.
There won't be the need for it.
Right. See what I'm saying? So it's saying falling. This whole system's going up. Okay? Remember what James said? I think it's very, very significant because he said a couple of things. First of all, he said, come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted and your garments have become moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have rusted and their rust will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. It is the last days that you stored up this your treasure. Okay, and then it goes on to say, because you wouldn't pay your laborers what you owed them, and so on and so forth. But interesting, he says, in the last days, he said, come you rich, weep and wail. He says, because your money has become what? It's become rusted and moth-eaten, and it will eat you, consume you like fire, and be a witness against you. In other words, look at the people that have money, and they got oodles and oodles and oodles and oodles of money. What did they do with their money? Do you think they go out and help the needy or help the poor or help the homeless, help these people? No. They're going out there to make more money with more money with more money with more money. And it says here that your silver has rusted. In other words, you didn't put it to use. You stored it up, counted it up, like the miser, right? And it says, your silver has rusted and their rust will be a witness against you and consume your flesh like fire. You know, what do we do with our money? James says this because I think it's very significant when it comes to what our problem is when it comes to money. He says this, what is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you, or wars for that matter? Is it not the source of your pleasures that wage war with your members? You lust for what? For money, material things, right? You lust and you do not have, so you commit murder. Like I said, how many murders have been committed for money? How many people have sold their bodies for money? Okay, how many robberies have been committed for money? How many swindles or swindlers or cons or, you know, this type of thing have done for money? It says, so you fight and quarrel and you do not have because you do not ask. And you ask and you do not receive because you ask with the wrong motives so that you may spend it on your pleasures. You adulteress, okay, this is what we're talking about, this whore. You adulteress, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. This is, you know, what money can do to you, all right? So you go back here and you read, you know, what he's saying in chapter 18. He read that verse 2. He says, and he cried out with a mighty voice, saying, fallen is Babylon the Great, and she has become the dwelling place of demons. Now listen to this. And a prison of every unclean spirit and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. Meaning what? Think, guys. Come on. What's going to happen in this particular city? It's going to be such a concentration of the lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, the pride of life, that people are going to be doing everything and anything for money. And remember, during the tribulation period, there's going to be tremendous holocausts that are going on all over the world. Okay, there's going to be starvation all over the place. There's going to be the wars and the famines and whatnot. But hey, people who, you know, are really into money, you know, they know how to turn all this stuff to their own advantage to make more and more money. What happens when there's a drought, or what happens when there's a crisis? You'll see a situation where what will happen? Where, like, for example, there's an earthquake. How many times do we read that people, there'll be a water shortage? So people jack up the price of the water, right? They're selling water, but they're saying, hey, it is $4 for a gallon of water. Yeah. I mean, is that not taking advantage of people, right? He's saying to become a dwelling place of demons and every unclean spirit. In other words, this city, there's going to be hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people that are going to be demon possessed. It is going to be incredible. All right? What's going to take place in this city? Okay, verse 3, it says, "For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of immorality." All the nations, like I said, there's been that lust for money, right? And they have done everything and anything for money. Offending God, you know, means nothing. You know, becoming rich means everything. "And the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality." Verse 4, "And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people." Whose voice would that be?
Yeah.
Unquestionably, it would be God, because it was my people. Now, this is during the tribulation period, okay? Now, this has been during a time when you can't buy or trade or sell without the mark, but apparently even some of God's people are in this city, okay? And there's a dark warning there. They may figure, well, I got to go to the city because, maybe I can do a job under the table or something to make ends meet, or whether because there's such a concentration of wealth there. And God said, hey, come out of her. You know, get out, because if you don't, you're going to receive her punishments. It says that come out of her, my people, that you may not participate in her sins and that you may not receive her plagues. Because once you are in that environment, it is so going to be so difficult not to become part of that sinful system. And, you know, believe me, in the tribulation period, things are going to be so difficult for so many people that they're going to turn to robbery and to becoming thieves and becoming, you know, they're just going to be breaking into homes and everything else. And this is the type of situation where it says you may not participate in their sins. Well, it would be very, very difficult to resist some of the temptations there, that you would do virtually anything for money in order to survive. In verse 5 it says, "For her sins have piled high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquity." Now, this is the thing. Back where this all began under Nimrod, they was trying to build a tower into heaven. But here, their sins have piled up to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquity. You know, God, it seems like God so often doesn't care. He's not concerned. He doesn't respond. Well, he's just so really long-suffering. It says that God remembers. He doesn't forget. Remember when God told the Jews, he says, hey, listen, when you get into your land, I want every seventh year to be a sabbatical year. You're not to do any farming, any harvesting, any planting. You let the ground lie fallow. You don't touch it. He says, because what I'll do in a sixth year, I'll give you a bumper crop. And in that bumper crop, it'll hold you over another year. That way you'll let the land rest. It'll rejuvenate itself. And you'll show obedience to me. But what happens? The love of money. They said, oh man, you know, I don't want to, you know, pass up this year, because look at all the money I could make. Or, you know, they show a disbelief in God, or lack of faith and trust in God, saying, well, gee, I don't know if, you know, we'll have enough to make it another year, so maybe we should plan again. Anyway, long story short, for 490 years, they broke the sabbatical year. Well, it's almost like, well, God didn't care. God didn't remember. God wasn't concerned. No. When he threw them out of their land, he told Jeremiah, these people are going to stay in Babylon as exiles for 70 years. Why?
One for each of those years that they didn't let the land rest.
Because 70 years would be the sum total of the 490 years that they were, and as far as the sabbatical years were concerned. In other words, God said this, you didn't let that land rest like I told you, I'm going to give it a rest. It's going to rest for 70 years to make up for all times you broke my law. It's like people that said, well, God didn't remember, he doesn't care. No, he remembers. It says here he remembered their iniquity. Verse 6, pay her back even as she has paid, and give her back to her double according to her deeds, in a cup which she has mixed twice as much for her. Now look what he's saying here. Pay her back how much? Twice as much. In the Old Testament, you had an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a bone for a bone, a break for a break, a life for a life. In other words, God instituted that law. And people say, well, gee, you know, that's pretty harsh. But you know what? That law acted as a deterrent. But what did it also do?
Limited it.
It acted as a restraint. In other words, if somebody knocked out your tooth, you couldn't take off their arm.
Yeah.
Okay? There was a ironclad safeguards put in there to restrain people from what? Vengeance.
Vengeance, yeah.
See? Bible says, vengeance is mine, says the Lord. So here, we don't see eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. We see vengeance. Because what does he say? Pay her back, even if she has been paid. Give her back to her double, according to her deeds, and the cup of which she has mixed twice as much for her. Verse 7, to the degree that she glorified herself and lived sensuously, to the same degree, give her torment and mourning. For she says in her heart, I will sit as a queen, I am not a widow, I will never be seen mourning. Now, I want to read this last part, and I just want to paraphrase this and see if it fits. Okay? I'm just making an application here. It's not my interpretation. To the degree that America has glorified herself and lived sensuously, to the same degree give her torment and mourning. For America says in her heart, I sit as a queen. I am not a widow. I will never see mourning. This country, remember the old slogan 8 years ago, it's the economy, stupid? Mm-hmm. Right? Okay? This is the thing that's so important to people, the economy, the economy, the economy, right? That they're willing to, you know, sell their souls for the economy. Well, this is us, sitting as a queen saying, hey, man, we are rich, we're rich. Everybody's boasting about how great the economy is. Yeah. I mean, I don't see it, but everybody's talking about it.
Yeah.
Okay? But this is what's happening. We, as America, sit as a queen. What are we doing? We sit as a queen and say, I'm not a widow. I will never see mourning. This nation thinks itself, we will never, ever have anybody invade our country. Is that what we think? Subconsciously, consciously, unconsciously? We think, hey, nobody's going to touch us. We're a superpower. We're the only superpower. Nobody would dare invade us. Nobody would dare lob nukes at us. And then in verse 8, it says, for this reason, in one day. Now, you take this literally. Okay? This doesn't apply for 1,000 years, 100 years, or whatever else some fool wants to come up with. It's one day. For this reason, one day her plagues will come upon her, pestilence and mourning and famine, and she will be burned up with fire. For the Lord God who judges her is strong. Okay? Take that literally. And the kings of the earth who committed acts of immorality and lived sensuously with her will weep and lament over her when they see the smoke of her burning. Standing at a distance because of the fear of her torment, saying, whoa, whoa, the great city of Babylon, the strong city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come. Now, we read three times, it says 1 hour. 1 hour, this whole thing is going to go up in smoke. You know what? It's kind of significant. I'm talking about it's 1 hour. Don't spiritualize this. Take it literally. But, you know, I think it's kind of significant because, you know, I had the Great London Fire back in 1666. There was 89 churches and 3,200 homes that were burned and 200,000 people homeless, but it burned for days and days and days. In 1811, you had the Great Chicago Fire where the supposedly Mr. O'Leary's cow kicked over the lantern, okay, and it burned for days and days and days. It killed 250 people. There were 17,450 structures that were destroyed, okay. There was over 100,000 homeless, but that was a fire that burned for days and days and days. And you got in 64 AD, you got 10 of the 14 precincts of Rome that were on fire, and that's when Nero supposedly played his fiddle while Rome was burning, and then he played it, blaming it on Christians. Look at all the forest fires that we have. Over 1 million acres have been burned, and more, hundreds of thousands of acres are still burning right now. But they've been burning for days and days and weeks, and some for months. But what are we reading here? This city is going to go up in smoke in 1 hour. 1 hour, 1 hour. It says it three times.
Look,
yeah, read on. It says here in verse 11, and the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her because no one buys her cargoes anymore. Now, this is what I'm saying. They're weeping over what? They're weeping over their money, over their stocks, their bonds, their cargo. Not the people, the thousands, perhaps millions of people that have gone up in smoke here. You see, this is where we're at today. Money means more and more than people. In America, I would say this, people's dogs mean more to them than their neighbors. I'm telling you, I'm so fed up with it. I really am. You know, when animals mean more than people. You know? And the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargo anymore. Cargoes of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet and every kind of citron wood, every article of ivory and every article made from very costly wood and bronze and iron and marble and cinnamon and spice and incense and perfume and frankincense and wine and olive oil and fine flour and wheat and cattle and sheep and cargoes of horses and chariots and slaves and human lives and the fruit you long for. Okay, now look at, like I was saying, it divides us up. In four different categories of seven, it's like a legal document. God saying, here, there's no loophole here. No way. This is all going up in smoke. Okay? Nobody can say, well, gee, you didn't say this. Maybe I can get away with that. You know, no. Okay? This is a situation where all of mankind has been seduced by the material things of the earth to the point where they have neglected God, ignored God, or turned their backs on God and worship this whore. And what does Paul say about someone who goes to a whore, a prostitute? He says in Corinthians that he becomes one with her. He used the analogy in Genesis where God said that the husband and wife were to become one flesh. Well, you become Well, if you're in a false religious system, you become one with that system. You're in this economic system, okay, as far as the idolatry is concerned, you are one with that system. And you're going up with it. In verse 14, it says, and the fruit you long for has gone from you, and all the things that were luxurious and splendid have passed away from you, and men will no longer find them. And the merchants of these things who became rich from her will stand at a distance. Now look at it. They stand at a distance. That's very important. Why? They stand at a distance because of the fear of her torment, weeping and mourning, saying, woe, woe, the great city, she who was clothed with fine linen and purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, for in 1 hour such great wealth has been laid waste, and every shipmaster and every passenger and sailor, and as many as make their living by the sea, stood at a distance. Now, I believe when we read this, we take it in light of everything else that's said in Revelation. This, to me, suggests that it's going to happen towards the end of the tribulation period. When this religious whore goes up in smoke, that's going to be mid-tribulation period. This is going to be just prior, before the bowl judgments. I believe this is going to happen probably weeks, maybe a few months before the end of the world. And it may very well be the thing that precipitates the war of Armageddon. Because this city, in my opinion, is going to go up by a thermonuclear bomb. Now, God could rain down from heaven a fire like he did Sodom and Gomorrah. He could do that, no question about it. But I believe that you see time and time again that God will use war as a means of judgment and punishment. And this could be either coming from China, or it could be, for that matter, a terrorist act. But I want to read something to you, and I read it a few nights ago. I didn't read all of it, but I just want to read portions of it. As far as what a thermonuclear bomb will do, and when we're talking about 1 hour here, this is a scenario. Basically, if a 20 megaton thermonuclear bomb exploded on a clear day at ground level on a large East Coast city, it would create a fireball 1.5 miles in diameter. Listen. The fireball will be 1.5 miles in diameter with temperatures of 20 to 30 million degrees Fahrenheit. Everything in the downtown area, the streets and the earth below, and all living things would be vaporized, leaving a crater several hundred feet deep. 6 miles from the epicenter, all people would be instantly killed by a huge silent heat flash traveling at the speed of light. Glass would melt and buildings would collapse when hit by a supersonic shock wave and winds of up to 300 miles an hour. Within a 10-mile radius, the blast wave, 180 miles per hour winds, and fires would inflict almost total casualties, with at least 50% dead and 40% injured. Even at 20 miles from the epicenter, 50% of the people would be killed or injured by direct thermonuclear radiation and blast pressures. A single nuclear device would result in tens of thousands of severe burn injuries. Many would be killed by random spontaneous fires fueled by oil storage tanks, natural gas lines, gasoline, and LNG tanks. These fires might combine into enormous firestorm, 1,200 square miles in an area, fanned by 100 to 200 mile per hour winds, creating temperatures incapable of cooking those in shelters. Survivors of the fires would be exposed to lethal and sublethal doses of radiation from short-term fallout. Even mild winds of 20 miles per hour would carry fallout as far as 150 miles, where everyone exposed would receive a lethal dose within 24 hours. This would cause acute radiation sickness and with decreased resistance to infection and so on and so forth. Now, you get the idea of what a 20 megaton bomb can do?
Yes, one bomb.
What it could do? And these people here, the merchants, are weeping and wailing at a distance. Why?
Because
of the fear of her torment. Okay? The fear of her torment. Okay? Now, this is speculative, but I think that there's a lot to be said that it's very possible this is all going to go up in a nuclear holocaust. Okay? The very epic center of the world as far as trade and commerce and materialism and money and wealth, everything can be tied up into this. Okay? And it's all going to go up. And he says here... In verse 15, it says, the merchants of these things who became rich from her will stand at a distance because of the fear of her torment, weeping and mourning, saying, woe, woe, the great city, she who has clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, in 1 hour such great wealth is laid waste. And every shipmaster and every passenger and sailor, and as many as make their living by the sea, stood at a distance, and were crying out as they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, what city is like the great city? And they threw dust in their heads, and they were crying out, weeping and mourning, morning, saying, "Woe, woe, the great city, and all which all who had ships at sea became rich by her wealth, if in 1 hour she has been laid waste." Now look at what's happened. You got three different classes of people who are weeping and mourning and wailing over this woman. You know, it's the shipmasters and all those who have become rich by her. And now you got three different classes of people who are rejoicing over her. Look at that verse 20. "Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets, because God has pronounced judgment for you against her." Okay, it says that rejoice who? The apostles and the prophets and the saints. Because so many of them have been tormented and persecuted and martyred throughout the centuries. Why? Not just because of their faith and commitment to Christ, but very often, you know, it had to do with the fact that they didn't fall into this world system. All right? And this world system ended up for you know, ulterior motives, or indirectly or directly, you know, killing them because of some kind of monetary exchange or value or something of that nature. Look at Jesus. What was he put to death for? 30 pieces of silver. And so it talks about the apostles, the prophets, the apostles. Well, they're the ones that have predicted her fall. Okay? Now keep something in mind when it comes to Babylon. He said here, in verse 21, "And a strong angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, Thus will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence, and it will not be found any longer. The sound of harpers and musicians and flute players and trumpeters will not be heard in you any longer, and no craftsman or craft will be found in you any longer, and the sound of a mill will not be heard in you any longer. The light of a lamp will not shine in you any longer, and the voice of the bridegroom and the bride will not be heard in you any longer, for your merchants were great men of the earth, because all the nations were deceived by your sorcery, and in her was found the blood of the prophets and the saints and all who have been slain on the earth." Now, what's kind of really significant here is that this strong angel, he comes down and he pronounces judgment, but he also, it says, another angel takes up this big, huge millstone. This is the only symbolism you find here. Millstone, and he throws it into the depths of the sea. Where did Jesus mention millstone?
Well, for the
Jesus said this: "Whoever causes one of the least of my brothers to sin or be a scandal to them, it would be better if he had a millstone tied around his neck and was cast in the depths of the sea." Believe me, you have a millstone tied around your neck, you cast in the depths of the sea, you're dead. You're dead meat. Okay. Right.
Like the mafia.
Okay. But Jesus said this: "It would be better if that happened to you." Why? Because there's a hell. Okay. Right. In other words, money has become a stumbling block. A stumbling block for so many people, right? Now, this Babylon, it's very important we recognize something. The prophets have foretold for centuries, Jeremiah and Isaiah in particular, but other prophets too, have foretold that Babylon would be violently overthrown. They would be violently overthrown like Sodom and Gomorrah. Keep something in mind. Babylon has never had a violent overthrow. Never. I think it's very important that we recognize this. Okay? Because, I'll just give you some examples. It was captured by the Medes and the Persians in 41 BC under Cyrus the Great. That was when Belshazzar was having his party. It was captured. But the city itself, it wasn't captured with a violent overthrow. As a matter of fact, you know, they diverted the ford to the river, and they were able to climb, the armies were able to go underneath the walls of the city, and they even bribed some of the guards, and they went and they slew the king. Never a violent overthrow. In 516 BC, there was a revolt against King Darius, but he subdued it. In 331 BC, Alexander went up against Babylon, but they opened the doors, welcomed him in with open arms. It was never destroyed. In 293 BC, some of the Greek kings, what they did is they built a rival city that was close to Babylon, but it was several miles away. That rival city eventually became an economic metropolis that drew a lot of these people from Babylon over to this particular city. And then in 60 AD, we know from Peter, 1 Peter 5:30, that Peter wrote a book from Babylon, his first epistle from Babylon. He tells us that. There was a congregation of Jews still living in Babylon. And in the 5th century, it was inhabited almost entirely by Jews. And in 917, it became an insignificant fishing village. And in 1100 AD, it had two mosques, so the Arabs were there. And in 1898, it had 10,000 people as inhabitants. But the city itself eventually became known as the city of Hillah. Well, that's been changed back to Babylon now. Okay, just before I close, let me give you some statistics about it. This is what Herodias was a Greek historian. He
he wrote about Babylon and what it looked like under Nebuchadnezzar. I think some of his statistics may have been lost in the translation, but look what he says about Babylon. Okay, he said this city was exactly 15 miles square, in other words, 60 miles in circumference, okay, under Babylon. It was surrounded by a brick wall 87 feet thick. In other words, you could drive about six chariots abreast across the top of the wall. Okay, it was 350 feet high. I think that was a mistake in translation because even archaeologists say it was more like 100. Okay, you don't need 350. 100 is plenty. Okay, it says on the walls were 250 towers. This whole city felt that they were totally, impregnable and insecure, right? Outside the city walls was a deep pit or a moat, which was used as another form of defense. Inside the wall was another wall, inside here, a smaller wall, for a secondary defense. It had huge, 25 huge avenues, 150 feet wide, ran from north to south, and in the same way crossed from east to west. All these different avenues going back and forth, okay? And it had, the city was divided into two equal parts by the Euphrates River. What they did is the Euphrates River was flowing down this way. They forded up the river, part of the river, and diverted the river to come right underneath the city, and then go back out and into the river. It was very ingenious. And then they said here the river of the city was spanned by a bridge, and at the end of each side of the bridge was a magnificent palace. In other words, there was a bridge here, and there was a palace on each side, and it connected on each side of the bridge, was subterranean passages or tunnels that ran beneath the river. In other words, there was subterranean passages underneath the river itself, and these became sumptuous banquet halls. They were made of brass, so people who had these palaces on each side of this river that were going through there, they'd go down in these subterranean passages, and the river would be flowing over them, but they'd be under there having these big parties. Near one of the places stood a Tower of Babel, and it was an observatory platform consisting of eight towers, each 75 feet high, rising one upon the other, with an outside winding stairway to its summit. And on the top of it was a chapel, okay, and the total height of this thing was like 660 feet. It wasn't the original Tower of Babel, but they constructed this. It was an observatory platform that they used to calculate the stars, and on top of that they had this massive chapel. And as a matter of fact, the chapel contained one of the most expensive pieces of furniture in the world. One golden image alone was 45 feet high, and it was valued at more than $20 million. And the sacred utensils were over $200 million. In other words, you get an idea from Herodias and other historians what Babylon was like. And remember Nebuchadnezzar? At one point in his life, he stood up and he looked around at everything he had, and he said, "Hey, isn't this Babylon, Babylon the Great, Babylon that I created?" And God had warned him a year ahead of time, "Hey, you're getting a little too proud here." Mm-hmm. And when he did that, an angel came down from heaven and took away his mind and gave him the mind of an animal. So for 7 years, he wandered around like a stupid dog in a field, and his fingernails grew this long, and his hair grew around all over the place, and he had the mind, he just ate like an animal. And God punished him for 7 years, and then he restored his mind. Do you remember that? He became so proud of the city that he was in charge of. And as a matter of fact, he built the Hanging Gardens of the Gardens of Babylon, the Hanging Gardens. They became one of the seven wonders of the world. It was something like 450 feet around. It's almost like 300 feet high. Okay? And he built this garden, these Hanging Gardens of Babylon, he built it for one of his wives because she was some country girl from Medo-Persia, so he wanted to impress her. So he built this thing, became one of the seven wonders of the world. As a matter of fact, Saddam Hussein in Iraq today has offered $1.5 million for anyone who can figure out an irrigation system that would work to where he can make a duplicate of this garden in Babylon. Okay, now I only share that kind of with you because you get an idea of what Babylon represented, not just as a concentration of all the false religious systems and the cults and the satanic worship and the occultism and all these other things, but it became so preoccupied and saturated with the lust and the love of money and greed and materialism. This is why God has pronounced such judgments against Babylon. And like I said, it's easy for Christians to say, well, gee, I would never get hooked up with this religious whore. But a lot of times we can get very, very involved with this economic whore and not see that we have become adulteresses as far as God is concerned. Okay? Anybody have anyone to add or share? I'm sorry we went a little bit over time.